Over dinner, they had not found the key that would open the doors in their souls and let them merge, which was their destiny. As they were leaving the restaurant, Roy was concerned that their moment of opportunity would pass and that their destiny would be thwarted. So he tapped the power of Dr. Kevorkian, which he'd recently absorbed from the television in the Learjet. He found the courage to reveal his true heart to Eve and force the fulfillment of their destiny. Behind the restaurant, a blue Dodge van was parked three spaces to the right of Eve's Honda, and a man and woman were getting out of it on their way to dinner. They were in their 40s, and the man was in a wheelchair. He was being lowered from a side door of the van on an electric lift, which he operated without assistance. Otherwise, the parking lot was deserted. To Eve, Roy said, "Come with me a minute. Come say hello." "Huh?" Roy walked directly to the Dodge. "Good evening," he said, as he reached under his coat to his shoulder holster. The couple looked up at him and both said, "Good evening," with a thread of puzzlement sewn through their voices as if trying to recall where they had met him before. "I feel your pain," Roy said as he drew his pistol. He shot the man in the head. His second round hit the woman in the throat, but it didn't finish her. She fell to the ground, twitching grotesquely. Roy stepped past the dead man in the wheelchair. To the woman on the ground, he said, "Sorry," and then he shot her again. The new silencer on the Beretta worked well. With the February wind moaning through the palm fronds, none of the three shots would have been audible farther than 10 feet away. Roy turned to Eve Jammer. She looked thunderstruck. He wondered if he had been too impulsive for a first date. "So sad," he said, "the quality of life that some people are forced to endure." Eve looked up from the bodies and met Roy's eyes. She didn't scream or even speak. Of course, she might have been in shock, but he didn't think that was the case. She seemed to want to understand. Maybe everything would be all right after all. "Can't leave them like this." He holstered his gun and pulled on his gloves. "They have a right to be treated with dignity." The remote control unit that operated the wheelchair lift was attached to the arm of the chair. Roy pressed a button and sent the dead man back up from the parking lot. He climbed into the van through the double-wide sliding door, which had been pushed to one side. When the wheelchair completed its ascent, he rolled it inside. Assuming that the man and woman were husband and wife, Roy planned the tableau accordingly. The situation was so public that he didn't have time to be original. He would have to repeat what he had done with the Bettenfields on Wednesday evening in Beverly Hills. Tall lampposts were spaced around the parking lot. Just enough bluish light came through the open window to allow him to do his work. He lifted the dead man out of the chair and placed him face up on the floor. The van was uncarpeted. Roy was remorseful about that, but he had no padding or blankets with which to make the couple's final rest more comfortable. He pushed the chair into a corner out of the way. Outside again, while Eve watched, Roy lifted the dead woman and put her into the van. He climbed in after her and arranged her beside her husband. He folded her right hand around her husband's left. Both of the woman's eyes were open, as was one of her husband's, and Roy was about to press them shut with his gloved fingers when a better idea occurred to him. He peeled up the husband's closed eyelid and waited to see if it would remain open. It did. He turned the man's head to the left and the woman's head to the right, so they were gazing into each other's eyes, into the eternity that they now shared in a far better realm than Las Vegas, Nevada, far better than any place in this dismal, imperfect world. He crouched at the feet of the cadavers for a moment, admiring his work. The tenderness expressed by their positions was enormously pleasing to him. Obviously, they had been in love, and were now together forever, as any lovers would wish to be. Eve Jammer stood at the open door, staring at the dead couple. Even the desert wind seemed to be aware of her exceptional beauty, and to treasure it, for her golden hair was shaped into exquisitely tapered streamers. She appeared not wind-blown, but wind-adored. "It's so sad," Roy said. "What quality of life could they have had, with him imprisoned in a wheelchair and with her tied to him by bonds of love? Their lives were so limited by his infirmities, their futures tethered to that damn chair. How much better now?" Without saying a word, Eve turned away and walked to the Honda. Roy got out of the Dodge van and, after one last look at the loving couple, closed the sliding door. Eve was waiting behind the wheel of her car with the engine running. If she had been frightened of him, she would have tried to drive away without him or would have run back to the restaurant. He got in the Honda and buckled his safety harness. They sat in silence. Clearly, she intuited that he was no murderer, that what he had done was a moral act, and that he operated on a higher plane than did the average man. Her silence was only indicative of her struggle to translate her intuition into intellectual concepts, and thereby more fully understand him. She drove out of the parking lot. Roy took off his leather gloves and returned them to the inside coat pocket from which he had gotten them. For a while, Eve followed a random route through a series of residential neighborhoods, just driving to drive, going nowhere yet. To Roy, the lights in all the huddled houses no longer seemed to be either warm or mysterious, as they had seemed on other nights and in other neighborhoods, in other cities, when he had cruised similar streets alone. Now they were merely sad. Terribly sad little lights that inadequately illuminated the sad little lives of people who would never enjoy a passionate commitment to an ideal, not of the sort that so enriched Roy's life. Sad little people who would never rise above the herd as he had risen, who would never experience a transcendent relationship with anyone as exceptional as Eve Jammer. When at last the time seemed right, he said, "I yearn for a better world, but more than better, Eve, oh, much more." She didn't reply. "Perfection," he said quietly, but with great conviction, "in all things. Perfect laws and perfect justice, perfect beauty. I dream of a perfect society, where everyone enjoys perfect health, perfect equality, in which the economy hums always like a perfectly tuned machine, where everyone lives in harmony with everyone else and with nature, where no offense is ever given or taken, where all dreams are perfectly rational and considerate, where all dreams come true." He was so moved by his soliloquy that his voice became thick toward the end of it, and he had to blink back tears. Still she said nothing. Night streets, lighted windows, little houses, little lives. So much confusion, sadness, yearning, and alienation in those houses. "I do what I can," he said, "to make an ideal world. I scrub away some of its imperfect elements and push it inch by grudging inch toward perfection. Oh, not that I think I can change the world, not alone, not me, and not even 1,000 or 100,000 like me. But I light a little candle whenever I can, one little candle after another, pushing back the darkness one small shadow at a time." They were on the east side of town, almost at the city limits, cruising into higher land and less populated neighborhoods than they had traveled previously. At an intersection, she suddenly made a U-turn and headed back into the sea of lights from which they'd come. "You may say I'm a dreamer," Roy admitted, "but I'm not the only one. I think you're a dreamer, too, Eve, in your own special way. If you can admit being a dreamer, maybe if all us dreamers can admit it and join together, the world could someday live as one." Her silence was now profound. He dared to look at her, and she was more devastating than he had remembered. His heart thudded slow and heavy, weighed down by the sweet burden of her beauty. When at last she spoke, her voice was quavery. "You didn't take anything from them." It wasn't fear that made her words shimmer as they passed along her elegant throat and across her ripe lips, but rather a tremendous excitement. And her tremulous voice in turn excited Roy. He said, "No, nothing. Not even the money from her purse or his wallet." "Of course not. I'm not a taker, Eve. I'm a giver."
"I've never seen..."
She seemed unable to find the words, even to describe what he had done. "Yes, I know," he said, delighted to see how completely he had swept her away.
"Never seen such..."
"Yes."
"Never such..."
"I know, dear one, I know."
"Such power," she said.
That was not the word he had thought that she was searching for, but she had pronounced it with such passion, imbued it with so much erotic energy, he could not be disappointed that she had yet to grasp the full meaning of what he had done.
"They were just going out for dinner,"
she said excitedly. She had begun to drive too fast, recklessly.
"Just going out to dinner, an ordinary night, nothing special, and wham, you whack them. Just like that. Jesus, take them out, and not even to get anything that belongs to them, not even because they crossed you or anything like that. Just for me, to show me who you really are."
"Well, yes, for you," he said, But not only for you, Eve. Don't you see? I remove two imperfect lives from creation, inching the world closer to perfection. And at the same time, I relieve those two sad people of the burden of this cruel life, this imperfect world, where nothing could ever be as they hoped. I gave to the world, and I gave to those poor people, and there were no losers.
You're like the wind, she said breathlessly. Like a fantastic storm wind, hurricane, tornado, except there's no weatherman to warn anyone you're coming. You got the power of the storm. You're a force of nature sweeping out of nowhere for no reason. Wham!
Worried that she was missing the point, Roy said, Wait a minute, Eve, listen to me. She was so excited that she couldn't drive anymore. She angled the Honda to the curb, tramped the brakes so hard that Roy would have been pitched into the windshield if his harness hadn't been buckled. Slamming the gear shift into park with nearly enough force to snap it off, she turned to him.
You're an earthquake, just like an earthquake. People can be walking along, carefree, sun shining, birds singing, and then the ground opens and just swallows them up.
She laughed with delight. Hers was a girlish, trilling, musical laugh, so infectious that he had difficulty not laughing with her. He took her hands in his. They were elegant, long-fingered, as exquisitely shaped as the hands of Guinevere, and the touch of them was more than any man deserved. Unfortunately, the radius and ulna above the perfectly shaped carpals of her wrist were not of the supreme caliber of the bones in her hands. He was careful not to look at them or touch them.
Eve, listen. You must understand. It's extremely important that you understand.
She grew solemn at once, realizing that they had reached a most serious point in their relationship. She was even more beautiful when somber than when laughing. He said,
You're right. This is a great power, the greatest of all powers, and that's why you've got to be clear about it.
Although the only light in the car came from the instrument panel, her green eyes blazed as if with the reflection of summer sun. They were perfect eyes, as flawless and compelling as those of the woman for whom he had been hunting this past year, whose photograph he carried in his wallet. Eve's left brow was perfect, too. But a slight irregularity marred her right superciliary arch above her eye socket. It was, regrettably, too prominent, only fractionally more so than the left, formed with barely half a gram too much bone, but nevertheless out of balance and shy of the perfection on the left. That was okay, he could live with that. He would just focus on her angelic eyes below her brow, and on each of her incomparable hands below her knobby radius and ulna. Though flawed, she was the only woman he had ever seen with more than one perfect feature. Ever, ever, ever. And her treasures weren't limited to her hands and eyes.
Unlike other power, Eve, this doesn't flow from anger, he explained, wanting this precious woman to understand his mission and his innermost self. It doesn't come from hatred, either. It's not the power of rage, envy, bitterness, greed. It's not like the power some people find in courage or honor, or that they gain from a belief in God. It transcends those powers, Eve. Do you know what it is?
She was rapt, unable to speak. She only shook her head. No.
My power, he said, is the power of compassion.
Compassion, she whispered.
Compassion. If you try to understand other people, to feel their pain, to really know the anguish of their lives, to love them in spite of their faults, you are overcome by such pity, such intense pity, it's intolerable. It must be relieved. So you tap into the immeasurable, inexhaustible power of compassion. You act to relieve suffering, to ease the world a hair's breadth closer to perfection.
Compassion, she whispered again. As if she had never heard the word before, or as if he had shown her a definition of it that she had never previously appreciated. Roy could not look away from her mouth as she repeated the word twice again. Her lips were divine. He couldn't imagine why he had thought that Melissa Wickland's lips were perfect, for Eve's lips made Melissa's seem less attractive than those of a leprous toad. These were lips beside which the ripest plum would look as withered as a prune, beside which the sweetest strawberry would look sour. Playing Henry Higgins to her Eliza Doolittle, he continued her first lesson in moral refinement.
When you're motivated solely by compassion, when no personal gain is involved, then any act is moral, utterly moral, and you owe no explanations to anyone, ever. Acting from compassion, you're freed forever from doubt. And that is a power like no other. Any act, she said, so overcome by the concept that she could barely find enough breath to speak.
Any, he assured her. She licked her lips. Oh, God, her tongue was so delicate, glistened so intriguingly, slipped so sensuously across her lips, was so perfectly tapered that a faint sigh of ecstasy escaped him before he was quite aware of it. Perfect lips, perfect tongue. If only her chin had not been tragically fleshy. Others might think it was the chin of a goddess, but Roy was cursed with a greater sensitivity to imperfection than were other men. He was acutely aware of the smidgen of excess fat that lent her chin a barely perceptible puffy look. He would just have to focus on her lips, on her tongue, and not allow his gaze to drift down from there.
"How many have you done?" she asked.
"Done? Oh, you mean like back at the restaurant?"
"Yes. How many?"
"Well, I don't count them. That would seem, I don't know, it would seem prideful. I don't want praise. No, my satisfaction is just in doing what I know is right. It's a very private satisfaction."
"How many?" she persisted. "A rough estimate."
"Oh, I don't know. Over the years, a couple of hundred, a few hundred, something like that." She closed her eyes and shivered.
"When you do them, just before you do them and they look in your eyes, are they afraid?"
"Yes, but I wish they weren't. I wish they could see that I know their anguish, that I'm acting from compassion, that it's going to be quick and painless."
With her own eyes closed, half swooning, she said,
"They look into your eyes and they see the power you have over them, the power of a storm, and they're afraid."
He released her right hand and pointed his forefinger at the flat section of bone immediately above the root of her perfect nose. It was a nose that made all the other fine noses seem unformed, as the nose on a coconut shell. Slowly he moved his finger toward her face as he said, "You have the most exquisite glabella I have ever seen."
With the last word, he touched his finger to her glabella, the flat portion of the front skull bone between her unimpeachable left superciliary arch and her unfortunately bony right superciliary arch directly above her nose. Although her eyes were closed, Eve didn't flinch with surprise at his touch. She seemed to have developed such a closeness to him so quickly that she was aware of his every intention and slightest movement without the aid of vision and without relying on any of the other five senses for that matter. He took his finger off her glabella. "Do you believe in fate?"
"Yes, we are fate."
She opened her eyes and said, "Let's go back to my place." On the trip to her house, she broke traffic laws by the score. Roy didn't approve, but he withheld his criticism. She lived in a small two-story house in a recently completed tract. It was nearly identical to the other houses on the street. Roy had expected glamour. Disappointed, he reminded himself that Eve, though stunning, was but another woefully underpaid bureaucrat. As they waited in the Honda in the driveway for the automatic garage door to finish lifting out of the way, he said, "How did a woman like you wind up working in the agency?" "I wanted the job, and my father had the influence to make it happen," she said, driving into the garage. "Who's your father?"
"He's a rotten son of a bitch," she said. "I hate him. Let's not go into all that, Roy, please. Don't ruin the mood."
The last thing he wanted to do was ruin the mood. Out of the car, at the door between the garage and the house, as Eve fumbled in her purse for keys, she was suddenly nervous and clumsy. She turned to him, leaned close.
"Oh, God, I can't stop thinking about it. How you did them. How you just walked up and did them. Such power in the way you did it."
She was virtually smoldering with desire. He could feel the heat rolling off her, driving the February chill out of the garage.
"You have so much to teach me," she said.
A turning point in their relationship had arrived. Roy needed to explain one more thing about himself. He'd been delaying bringing it up for fear she would not understand this one quirk as easily as she had absorbed and accepted what he'd had to say about the power of compassion, but he could delay no longer. As Eve returned her attention to her purse and at last extracted the ring of keys from it, Roy said, "I want to see you undressed."
"Yes, darling, yes," she said,
and the keys clinked noisily as she searched for the right one on the ring. He said, "I want to see you entirely nude."
"Entirely, yes, all for you."
"I have to know how much of the rest of you is as perfect as the perfect parts that I can already see." "You're so sweet," she said, hastily inserting the correct key into the deadbolt lock. From the soles of your feet to the curve of your spine, to the backs of your ears, to the pores in the skin of your scalp. I want to see every inch of you, nothing hidden, nothing at all. Throwing open the unlocked door, rushing inside, switching on a kitchen light, she said, "Oh, you are too much. You are so strong. Every crevice, darling, every inch and fold and crevice." As she dropped her purse and keys on the kitchen table and began to strip out of her coat, he followed her inside and said, "But that doesn't mean I want to undress or anything." That stopped her. She blinked at him. He said, "I want to see and touch you. But not much of that, just a little touching when something looks perfect. To feel if the skin is as smooth and silky as it appears, to test the resilience, to feel if the muscle tension is as wonderful as it looks. You don't have to touch me at all," he hurried on, afraid that he was losing her. "I want to make love to you, to the perfect parts of you, make passionate love with my eyes, with a few quick touches, perhaps, but with nothing else. I don't want to spoil it by doing what other people do. Don't want to debase it. Don't need that sort of thing." She stared at him so long that he almost turned and fled. Suddenly Eve squealed shrilly, and Roy took a step back, more than half afraid of her. Offended and humiliated, she might fling herself at him and claw his face, tear at his eyes. Then, to his astonishment, he realized that she was laughing. Though not cruelly, not laughing at him, she was laughing with pure joy. She hugged herself and squealed as if she were a schoolgirl, and her sublime green eyes shone with delight. "My God," she said tremulously, "you're even better than you seemed, even better than I thought, better than I could ever hope. You're perfect, Roy, you're perfect, perfect." He smiled uncertainly. He was still not entirely free of the fear that she was going to claw him. Eve grabbed his right hand, pulled him through the kitchen, across a dining room, snapping on lights and talking as she went. "I was willing, if you wanted that. But that's not what I want either. All that pawing and squeezing, all that sweating. It disgusts me, having another person sweat all over me, all slick and sticky with another person's sweat. I can't stand that. It sickens me." "Fluids," he said with revulsion. "How can there be anything sexy about another person's fluids, exchanging fluids?" With growing excitement, pulling him into a hallway, Eve said, "Fluids, my God, doesn't it make you want to die, just die, with all the fluids that have to be involved, so much that's wet. They all want to lick and suck my breasts, all that saliva, it's so hideous, and shoving their tongues in my mouth." "Spittle," he said, grimacing. "What's so erotic about swapping spit, for God's sake?" They had reached the threshold of her bedroom. He stopped her on the brink of the paradise that they were about to create together. "If I ever kiss you," he promised, "it will be a dry kiss, as dry as paper, dry as sand." Eve was shaking with excitement. "No tongue," he swore. "Even the lips mustn't be moist."
"And never lips to lips."
"Because then, even in a dry kiss,
we'd be swapping
breath for breath.
And there's moisture in breath.
Vapors from the lungs," he said. With a gladdening of his heart almost too sweet to endure, Roy knew that this splendid woman was indeed more like him than he ever could have hoped when he first stepped out of that elevator and saw her. They were two voices in harmony, two hearts beating in unison, two souls soaring to the same song, emphatically simpatico.
"No man has ever been in this bedroom," she said, leading him across the threshold. "Only you, only you."
The portion of the walls immediately to the left and right of the bed, as well as the area of the ceiling directly above it, was mirrored. Otherwise, the walls and ceiling were upholstered with midnight blue satin, the precise shade of the carpet. A single chair stood in a corner, upholstered in silvery silk. The two windows were covered with polished nickel blinds. The bed was sleek and modern, with radius footboard, bookcase headboard, tall flanking cabinets, and a light bridge. It was finished with several coats of high-gloss midnight blue lacquer, in which glimmered silvery speckles like stars. Above the headboard was another mirror. Instead of a bedspread, she had a silver fox fur throw. "Just fake fur," she assured him when he expressed concern about the rights of helpless animals, which was the most lustrous and luxurious thing he had ever seen. Here was the glamour for which Roy had yearned. The computerized lighting was voice-activated. It offered six distinct moods through clever combinations of strategically placed halogen pin spots with a variety of colored lenses, mirror-framing neon in three colors that could be displayed singly or two or three at a time, and imaginative applications of fiber optics. Furthermore, each mood could be subtly adjusted by a voice-activated rheostat that responded to the commands up and down. When Eve touched a button on the headboard, the tambour doors on the tall bed-flanking cabinets hummed up out of sight. Shelves were revealed, laden with bottles of lotions and scented oils, 10 or 12 rubber phalluses in various sizes and colors, and a collection of battery-powered and hand-operated sex toys that were bewildering in their design and complexity. Eve switched on a CD player with a 100-disc carousel and set it for random play. It's loaded with everything from Rod Stewart to Metallica, Elton John, Garth Brooks, the Beatles, the Bee Gees, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Seger, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, James Brown, and the famous Flames, and Box Goldberg variations. Somehow it's more exciting when there's so many different kinds of music.
No fluids, no pawing.
Suddenly, she said, I'm as shy as a virgin.
I could stare at you for hours, fully clothed. She tore off her blouse so violently that buttons popped and the fabric ripped. In a minute she was completely nude, and more of what had been hidden proved to be perfect than imperfect. Reveling in his gasp of pleased disbelief, she said,
You see why I don't like to make love in the usual way? When I have me, what do I need with anyone else?
Thereafter she turned from him and proceeded as she would have done if he'd not been there. Clearly, she took intense satisfaction from knowing that she could hold him totally in her power without ever having to touch him. She stood before the mirror, examining herself from every angle, caressing herself tenderly, wonderingly, and her rapture at what she saw was so exciting to Roy that he could draw only shallow breaths. When she finally went to the bed, with Bruce Springsteen singing about whiskey and cars, she cast off the Silver Fox throw. For just a moment, Roy was disappointed, for he had wanted to see her writhing upon those lustrous pelts, whether faux or real. But she pulled back the top sheet and the lower sheet as well, revealing a black rubber mattress cover that instantly intrigued him. From a shelf in one of the open cabinets, she removed a bottle of Jewel Pure Amber Oil, unscrewed the cap, and poured a small pool of it in the center of the bed. A subtle and appealing fragrance, as light and fresh as a spring breeze, drifted to Roy. Not a floral scent, but spices, cinnamon, ginger, and other more exotic ingredients. While James Brown sang about urgent desire, Eve rolled onto the big bed, straddling the puddle of oil. She anointed her hands and began working the amber essence into her flawless skin. For 15 minutes her hands moved knowingly over every curve and plane of her body, lingering at each lovely, yielding roundness and at each shadowy, mysterious cleft. More often than not, what Eve touched was perfect. But when she touched a part that was beneath Roy's standards and dismaying to him, he focused on her hands, for they themselves were without flaw, at least below the 2 bony radii and ulni. The sight of Eve upon the glistening black rubber, her lush body all gold and pink, slick with a fluid that was satisfyingly pure and not of human origin, had elevated Roy Miro to a spiritual plane that he had never before attained, not even by the use of secret Eastern techniques of meditation, not even when a channeler had once brought forth the spirit of his dead mother at a seance in Pacific Heights, not even with peyote or vibrating crystals or high colonic therapy administered by an innocent-looking 20-year-old technician dressed accommodatingly as a Girl Scout. And judging by the lazy pace that she had set, Eve expected to spend hours in the exploration of her magnificent self. Consequently, Roy did something that he had never done before. He took his pager from his pocket, and because there was no way to switch off the beeper on this particular model, he popped open the plastic plate on the back and removed the batteries. For one night, his country would have to get along without him, and suffering humanity would have to make do without its champion. Pain brought Spencer out of a black-and-white dream featuring surreal architecture and mutant biology, all the more disturbing for the lack of color. His entire body was a mass of chronic aches, dull and relentlessly throbbing, but a sharp pain in the top of his head was what broke the chains of his unnatural sleep. It was still night, or night again, he didn't know which. He was lying on his back on an air mattress under a blanket. His shoulders and head were elevated by a pillow and by something under the pillow. The soft hissing sound and characteristic eerie glow of a Coleman lantern identified the light source somewhere behind him. The lambent light revealed weather-smoothed rock formations to the left and right. Directly ahead of him lay a slab of what he supposed was the Mojave with an icing of night, which the beams of the lantern couldn't melt.
Overhead, stretched from one thrust of rock to the other, was a cover of desert camouflage canvas. Another sharp pain lanced across his scalp.
"Be still," she said.
He realized that his pillow rested on her crossed legs and that his head lay in her lap.
"What are you doing?"
He was spooked by the weakness of his own voice. She said, "Sewing up this laceration."
"You can't do that."
"Keeps breaking open and bleeding."
"I'm not a quilt."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"You're not a doctor."
"Aren't I?"
"Are you?"
"No. Be still."
"It hurts."
"Of course."
"It'll get infected,"
he worried. I shaved the area first, then sterilized it.
"You shaved my head?"
"Just one little spot around the gash."
"Do you have any idea what you're doing?"
"You mean in terms of barbering or doctoring?"
"Either one."
"I've got a little basic knowledge."
"Ouch, damn it."
"If you're going to be such a baby, I'll use a spritz of local anesthetic."
"You have that? Why didn't you use it?"
"You were already unconscious." He closed his eyes, walked through a black and white place made of bones under an arch of skulls, and then opened his eyes again and said,
Well, I'm not now."
"You're not what?"
"Unconscious," he said.
"You just were again. A few minutes passed between our last exchange and this one, and while you were out that time, I almost finished. Another stitch and I'm through."
"Why'd we stop?"
"You weren't traveling well."
"Sure I was."
"You needed some treatment. Now you need rest. Besides, the cloud cover is breaking up fast."
"Got to go. Early bird gets the tomato."
"Tomato? That's interesting." He frowned.
"I said tomato? Why are you trying to confuse me?"
"Because it's so easy. There, the last suture." Spencer closed his grainy eyes. In the somber black and white world, jackals with human faces were prowling the vine-tangled rubble of a once great cathedral. He could hear children crying in rooms hidden beneath the ruins. When he opened his eyes, he found that he was lying flat. His head was now elevated only a couple of inches on the pillow. Valerie was sitting on the ground beside him, watching over him. Her dark hair fell softly along one side of her face, and she was pretty in the lamplight.
"You're pretty in the lamplight," he said.
"Next you'll be asking if I'm an Aquarius or a Capricorn."
"Nah, I don't give a shit,"
she laughed.
"I like your laugh," he said.
She smiled, turned her head, and ruminated on the dark desert. He said,
"What do you like about me?"
"I like your dog."
"He's a great dog. What else?"
Looking at him again, she said, "You've got nice eyes."
"I do."
"Honest eyes."
"Are they? You used to have nice hair, too, all shaved off now. I was butchered."
"Barbered, just one small spot."
"Barbered and then butchered. What are you doing out here in the desert?"
She stared at him a while, then looked away without answering. He wouldn't let her off that easily.
"What are you doing out here? I'll just keep asking until the repetition drives you insane. What are you doing out here?"
"Saving your ass."
"Tricky. I mean, what were you doing here in the first place?"
"Looking for you."
"Why?"
he wondered. "Because you've been looking for me."
"But how'd you find me, for God's sake?"
"Ouija board."
"I don't think I can believe anything you say."
"You're right. It was tarot cards."
"Who were we running from?"
She shrugged. The desert engaged her attention again. At last she said, "History, I guess."
"There you go, trying to confuse me again."
"Specifically the cockroach."
"We're running from a cockroach?"
"That's what I call him, because it infuriates him." His gaze rolled from Valerie to the tarp that hung 10 feet above them.
"Why the roof?"
"Blends with the terrain. It's a heat-dispersing fabric, too, so we won't show up strong on any infrared lookdown."
"Lookdown?"
"Eyes in the sky."
"God?"
"No, the cockroach."
"The cockroach has eyes in the sky?"
"He and his people, yeah." Spencer thought about that. Finally, he said,
"I'm not sure if I'm awake or dreaming."
"Some days," she said, "neither am I." In the black and white world, the sky seethed with eyes, and a great white owl flew overhead, casting a moon shadow in the shape of an angel. Eve's desire was insatiable, and her energy was inexhaustible, as though each protracted bout of ecstasy electrified rather than enervated her. At the end of an hour, she seemed more vital than ever, more beautiful, aglow. Before Roy's adoring eyes, her incredible body seemed to be sculpted and pumped up by her ceaseless rhythmic flexing, contracting, flexing, by her writhing, thrashing, thrusting, just as a long session of lifting weights pumped up a bodybuilder. After years of exploring all the ways she could satisfy herself, she enjoyed a flexibility that Roy judged to be somewhere between that of a gold medal Olympic gymnast and a carnival contortionist, combined with the endurance of an Alaskan dog sled team. There was no doubt whatsoever that a session in bed with herself provided a thorough workout for every muscle from her radiant head to her cute toes. Regardless of the astounding knots into which she tied herself, regardless of the bizarre intimacy she took with herself, she never looked at all grotesque or absurd, but unfailingly beautiful from any angle, in even the most unlikely acts. She was always milk and honey on that black rubber, peaches and cream, flowing and smooth, the most desirable creature ever to grace the earth. Halfway through the second hour, Roy was convinced that 60% of this angel's features, body and face overall, were perfect by even the most stringent standards. Another 35% of her was not perfect, but so close to perfect as to break his heart. And only 5% was plain. Nothing about her, no slightest line or concavity or convexity, was ugly. Roy was certain that Eve must soon stop pleasuring herself or otherwise collapse unconscious, but by the end of the second hour she seemed to have more appetite and capacity than when she'd begun. The power of her sensuality was so great that every piece of music was changed by her horizontal dance, until it seemed that all of it, even the Bach, had been expressly composed as the score for a pornographic movie. From time to time she called out the number of a new lighting arrangement, said up or down to the rheostat, and her selection was always the most flattering for the next position into which she folded herself. She was thrilled by watching herself in the mirrors, and by watching herself watch herself, and by watching herself as she watched herself watching herself. The infinity of images bounced back and forth between the mirrors on opposite walls until she could believe that she had filled the universe with replications of herself. The mirrors seemed magical, transmitting all the energy of each reflection back into her own dynamic flesh, overloading her with power until she was a runaway blonde engine of eroticism. Sometime during the third hour, batteries gave out in a few of her favorite toys, gears froze in others, and she surrendered herself once more to the expertise of her own bare hands. For a while, in fact, her hands seemed to be separate entities from her, each alive in its own right. They were in such a frenzy of lust that they couldn't occupy themselves with just one of her many treasures for any length of time. They kept sliding over her ample curves, up around, down her oiled skin, massaging and tweaking and caressing and stroking one delight after another. They were like a pair of starving diners at a fabulous smorgasbord that had been prepared to celebrate the imminence of Armageddon, allowed only precious seconds to gorge themselves before all was obliterated by a sun gone nova. But the sun did not go nova, of course, and eventually, if gradually, those matchless hands slowed, slowed, finally stopped, and were sated, as was their mistress. For a while after it was over, Roy couldn't get up from his chair. He couldn't even slump back from the edge of it. He was numb, paralyzed, tingling strangely in every extremity. In time, Eve rose from the bed and stepped into the adjoining bathroom. When she returned, carrying two plush towels, one damp, one dry, she was no longer gleaming with oil. With the damp cloth, she removed the glistening residue from the rubber mattress cover, then carefully wiped it down with the dry towel. She replaced the bottom sheet that she had earlier cast off. Roy joined her on the bed. Eve lay on her back, her head on a pillow. He stretched out beside her on his back, his head on another pillow. She was still gloriously nude, and he remained fully clothed, though at some point during the night he had loosened his necktie by an inch. Neither of them made the mistake of trying to comment upon what had transpired. Mere words could not have done the experience justice, and might have made a nearly religious odyssey seem somehow tawdry. Anyway, Roy already knew that it had been good for Eve, and as for himself, well, he had seen more physical human perfection in those few hours, and in action, than in his entire life theretofore. After a while, gazing at his darling's reflection on the ceiling as she stared at his, Roy began to talk, and the night entered a new phase of communion that was nearly as intimate, intense, and life-changing as the more physical phase that had preceded it. He spoke further about the power of compassion, refining the concept for her. He told her that humankind always hungered for perfection. People would endure unendurable pain, accept awful deprivation, countenance savage brutalities, live in constant and abject terror, if only they were convinced that their sufferings were the tolls that must be paid on the highway to utopia, to heaven on earth. A person motivated by compassion, yet who was also aware of the masses' willingness to suffer, could change the world. Although he, Roy Miro, of the merry blue eyes and Santa Claus smile, did not believe that he possessed the charisma to be that leader of leaders who would launch the next crusade for perfection, he hoped to be one who served that special person and served him well. "I light my little candles," he said, "one at a time." For hours, Roy talked while Eve interjected numerous questions and perceptive comments. He was excited to see how she thrilled to his ideas, almost as she had thrilled to her battery-powered toys and to her own practiced hands. She was especially moved when he explained how an enlightened society ought to expand on the work of Dr. Kevorkian, compassionately assisting in the self-destruction not solely of suicidal people, but also of those poor souls who were deeply depressed, offering easy exits not only to the terminally ill, but to the chronically ill, the disabled, the maimed, the psychologically impaired. And when Roy talked about his concept of a suicide assistance program for infants, to bring a compassionate solution to the problem of babies born with even the slightest defects that might affect their lives, Eve made a few breathless sounds similar to those that had escaped her in the throes of passion. She pressed her hands to her breasts once more, though this time only in an attempt to quiet the fierce pounding of her heart. As Eve filled her hands with her bosoms, Roy could not take his eyes off the reflection of her that hovered above him. For a moment he thought that he might weep at the sight of her 60% perfect face and form. Sometime before dawn, intellectual orgasms sent them spiraling into sleep, as physical orgasms had not the power to do. Roy was so fulfilled that he didn't even dream. Hours later, Eve woke him. She had already showered and dressed for the day. "You've never been more radiant," he told her. "You've changed my life," she said. "And you mine." Although she was late for work in her concrete bunker, she drove him to the Strip Hotel, at which Proc, his taciturn driver from the previous night, had left his luggage. It was Saturday, but Eve worked 7 days a week. Roy admired her commitment. The desert morning was bright. The sky was a cool, serene blue. At the hotel, under the entrance portico, before Roy got out of the car, he and Eve made plans to see each other soon, to experience again the pleasures of the night just past. He stood by the front entrance to watch her drive away. When she was gone, he went inside. He passed the front desk, crossed the raucous casino, and took an elevator to the 36th and highest floor in the main tower. He didn't recall putting one foot in front of the other, since getting out of her car, as far as he knew, he had floated into the elevator. He had never imagined that his pursuit of the fugitive bitch and the scarred man would lead him to the most perfect woman in existence. Destiny was a funny thing. When the doors opened at the 36th floor, Roy stepped into a long corridor with custom-sculpted, tone-on-tone, wall-to-wall Edward Fields carpet. Wide enough to be considered a gallery rather than a hallway, the space was furnished with early 19th-century French antiques and paintings of some quality from the same period. This was one of three floors originally designed to offer huge luxury suites free of charge to high rollers who were willing to wager fortunes at the games downstairs. The 35th and 34th floors still served that function. However, since the agency had purchased the resort for its money-making and money-laundering potential, the suites on the top floor had been set aside for the convenience of out-of-town operatives of a certain executive level. The 36th floor was served by its own concierge, who was established in a cozy office across from the elevator. Roy picked up the key to his suite from the man on duty, Henri, who didn't so much as raise an eyebrow over the rumpled condition of his guest's suit. Key in hand, on his way to his rooms, whistling softly, Roy looked forward to a hot shower, a shave, and a lavish room service breakfast. But when he opened the gilded door and went into the suite, he found two local agents waiting for him. They were in a state of acute but respectful consternation, and only when Roy saw them did he remember that his pager was in one of his jacket pockets and the batteries in another.
We've been looking everywhere for you since 4 o'clock this morning, said one of his visitors. We've located Grant's explorer, said the second. Abandoned, said the first. There's a ground search underway for him, though he might be dead, or rescued, because it looks like someone got there before us. Anyway, there are other tire tracks, so we don't have much time. We've got to move.
In his mind's eye, Roy pictured Eve Jammer, golden and pink, oiled and limber, writhing on black rubber, more perfect than not. That would sustain him, no matter how bad the day proved to be. Spencer woke in the purple shade under the camouflage tarp, but the desert beyond was bathed in harsh white sunshine. The light stung his eyes, forcing him to squint, although that pain was nothing compared with the headache that cleaved his brow from temple to temple on a slight diagonal. Against the backs of his eyeballs, red light spun with the abrasiveness of razor-blade pinwheels. He was hot as well, burning up, though he suspected that the day was not especially warm. Thirsty, his tongue felt swollen. It was stuck to the roof of his mouth. His throat was scratchy, raw. He was still lying on an air mattress with his head on a meager pillow, under a blanket in spite of the insufferable heat. But he was no longer lying alone. The woman was snuggled against his right side, exerting a sweet pressure against his flank, hip, thigh. Somehow he had gotten his right arm around her without meeting an objection. Way to go, Spence, my man. And now he relished the feel of her under his hand. So warm, so soft, so sleek, so furry. Uncommonly furry for a woman. He turned his head and saw Rocky.
Hi, pal.
Talking was painful. Each word was a spiny burr being torn out of his throat. His own speech echoed piercingly through his skull as though it had been stepped up by amplifiers inside his sinus cavities. The dog licked Spencer's right ear. Whispering to spare his throat, he said,
Yeah, I love you too.
Am I interrupting anything? Valerie asked, dropping to her knees at his left side.
Just the boy and his dog hanging out together.
How are you feeling?
Lousy.
Are you allergic to any drugs?
I hate the taste of Pepto-Bismol.
Are you allergic to any antibiotics?
Everything's spinning.
Are you allergic to any antibiotics?
Strawberries give me hives.
Are you delirious or just difficult?
Both.
Maybe he drifted away for a while because the next thing he knew she was giving him an injection in his left arm. He smelled the alcohol with which she had swabbed the area over the vein.
Antibiotic,
he whispered. Liquefied strawberries.
The dog was no longer lying at Spencer's side. He was sitting next to the woman, watching with interest as she withdrew the needle from his master's arm. Spencer said,
I have an infection.
Maybe secondary. I'm taking no chances.
You a nurse?
Not a doctor, not a nurse.
How do you know what to do?
He tells me, she said, indicating Rocky.
Always joking. Must be a comedian.
Yes, but licensed to give injections. Do you think you can hold down some water?
How about bacon and eggs?
Water seems hard enough. Last time you spit it up.
Disgusting.
You apologized.
I'm a gentleman.
Even with her assistance, he was tested to his limits merely by the effort required to sit up. He choked on the water a couple of times, but it tasted cool and sweet, and he thought he would be able to keep it in his stomach.